This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Thanks for listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Today, we're featuring an interview with medical doctor, United Nations Goodwill Envoy, and acclaimed writer, Khaled Hosseini. Khaled Hosseini's first novel, The Kite Runner, became an international bestseller and later a movie. He's also the author of A Thousand Splendid Suns and the recently published And the Mountains Echoed. Hosseini's writing is set on the backdrop of life in Afghanistan and Northern California, with inspiration from his own life experiences. While on tour, he stopped by KBOO to chat with me about his work with the UN and the Khaled Hosseini Foundation. We began our conversation with the story of his family leaving Afghanistan under political asylum.
When I was 11 when we left Afghanistan, that would have been October of 76. My family and I moved to Paris, France in October of 76, and we were supposed to come back in 1980. My father was assigned to a position in the Afghan embassy in Paris, and while we were there, things fell apart in Afghanistan, and so my dad applied for asylum for the family, and we moved from Paris to San Jose, California in 1980, and I've lived in California ever since. I've been in this country now for 32 years.
How did you end up in San Jose, California?
Well, we had an Afghan lady who was our sponsor, and she lived in San Jose. So we moved there to be near her and just loved it, loved the Bay Area, and just never moved away. My parents lived in the same, more or less same square mile or two for the better part of 30 years.
And there was a big Afghan community out there?
Or? There wasn't then, but we were sort of in that first wave of families that were taking refuge from Afghanistan's troubles. I remember there were a number of other families in the Bay Area, but nothing like the community that's in the Bay Area now. Today in the East Bay, the cities of Fremont, Union City, Hayward, there are more Afghans than anywhere in the world, with the exception of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. So it's a massive community. But we were sort of, I like to think of us as part of that original seed of the big Afghan-American community that exists now. So the friends that we made in the early 1980s, you know, we're still friends with now.
It is incredible to be part of that first wave of immigrants that come to a city and establish what influences the community. And before we talk about that, but you couldn't return to Afghanistan for many years. Talk about why you couldn't go back and how many years passed before you were able to make your first trip back.
Well, of the nine of us, and there was five kids, my mom, my dad, my grandmother, my aunt, we moved together to the Bay Area. Of the nine of us, the only one who ever went back was me. And I, as I said, we left in 76. I returned in 2003. So there was a 27-year absence from Afghanistan. And we really couldn't go back because there was never any peace and calm, seemingly, in Afghanistan. There was one war after another. And also because so many of our friends and families moved, much of our relatives, most of them moved from Afghanistan in the 1980s and settled either in Europe or in the United States. So there was really sort of nobody to go back to either. I returned in 2003 once, you know, I had somebody to go back with. I went back with my brother-in-law. We decided we would go back and just, I don't know, educate ourselves about what had happened there and just kind of reconnect and just kind of see for ourselves. I mean, I've been dying to go back for years and years. I just, the right time never seemed to come. And finally, the opportunity presented itself and I took the chance and we went back.
What was the opportunity in 2003 that presented itself?
Well, there seemed suddenly, you know, the city seemed safe enough. The Taliban were gone. And my brother-in-law and I were chatting one day, and I told him, I said, I'm dying to go back, but I kind of don't want to go alone because I don't know anybody. And he said, you know, I want to go too. And his father was the deputy foreign minister in Afghanistan at that time. So when we stayed at his father's house, we were there 2 weeks, and it was a pretty unforgettable experience.
Well, that was my next question about your unforgettable experience.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the first time going back after
27 years? Yeah, it was a pretty intense because, you know, I left the city in 76 when there was maybe 500,000 people living there. It was a fairly quiet place. I mean, it was a cosmopolitan city, but by the standards of Tehran or Beirut or other major cities in the region, it was, you know, fairly sleepy. And I went back, and it was this overpopulated, massive city. Many, many of the neighborhoods had been just razed to the ground, completely demolished. You know, and the scars of the wars, were everywhere. Every street corner, there was something to remind you that there was conflict here. It was overwhelming at first. And it's really one thing to just kind of read about it in the newspaper, see it on television, but to actually walk the streets where these rockets had demolished these entire, you know, buildings and massive holes in the streets and people living on the ground, it was pretty intense. And it took me several days to acclimate. I recognized many of the city's landmarks. I had a reasonably intact sort of mental compass of the city, and I was able to go back and retrace my steps and find the house where I grew up, the house that my father had built, and was able to actually even take a walk through it and saw how it had changed. And it's funny because in my first novel and the latter part of the book, which I wrote, the entire book was written by the time I went to Kabul, so I wrote it and then went to Kabul. I had my protagonist go to Kabul and find his father's house and walk through it, and he had this very strange experience. Oh, this house in my memories was so big, and look at it, it's so small, and it had completely fallen apart. And I had that identical experience going back, and I just couldn't believe that the house in that memory that seemed like this big house and sprawling garden was just sort of this 1,200 square foot place with a little garden, and it seemed so diminished. But you know, the whole experience was very emotional.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's always emotional to go back to a place where you once lived and see how it changes, but this is obviously a much more magnified experience.
And there's also complicated feelings involved with it, because it's not just all about the nostalgic part of it. It really is also, and I sensed, and there's a chapter in the new novel that is sort of reflects my experience of going back to Afghanistan for the first time, in that I went there and I kind of felt like I've come home. This is where I was born. This is where I was raised. I went to school here. I made my first friends here. I learned how to speak there. So it's like, this is my city. And at the same time, it felt untruthful to really believe that, to really say that, because so many of the experiences of the people on the streets had completely bypassed me. My life was radically different than the lives of the people on the streets. And so I felt both at home and also in exile. And it was a very kind of a strange no man's land, a place to land, to find myself. You know, I wasn't sure how to engage with the locals, quite frankly. I was always kind of sort of careful not to act like I was entitled to their stories. I felt a little bit guilty about my own life and, you know, how lucky I've been. A lot guilty. I dealt with it much better in the subsequent trips that I took. But that first one was, you know, it was a pretty heavy experience.
Well, I was curious if you had any of the community, people that you interacted with a lot as a kid that you knew, how they received your homecoming in that first trip and subsequent trips.
Well, the only person that I saw in Afghanistan that first time for my former life was a great aunt of mine who was a lovely lady. She has since passed away. But I went and paid my respects to her, and she recognized me, and we had a lovely afternoon together. And we talked about the past, and we talked about our families, and she had lived in Kabul and never moved away. Other than her, there was really nobody left. Everybody is gone, either, you know, like I said, in Europe or the U.S. I did recognize people in Kabul, but there were people that I knew from California. There were Afghans who were doing very much what I was doing, had gone, some of them had gone to, you know, start businesses, to sell land, you know, to hang out with others. But, you know, some of them were like me, just kind of passing through. And so I did recognize people from California, and you know, people I knew in the U.S.
Talking a little bit about your experience in California, you and your family moved here under political asylum, and you were a child, but probably, you know, could remember.
A teenager.
And you came from a family of privilege, being that your father was a diplomat, mm-hmm. and you came here and experienced a number of cultural and socioeconomic shifts from what I understand, having to receive government benefits and things like that. Can you talk about that transition?
Well, the transition was tough for all of us. I think it was particularly tough on my parents. It was tough on us too, and I can speak to that. But I think for my parents, it was a real blow because, I mean, they were in their early 40s. My mom was in her late 30s. My dad was in his early 40s. And, they had worked hard their life for their careers. They were established people, professionals, educated people. And then, suddenly we're in San Jose with a suitcase of clothes and nothing else, literally nothing else. And everything of that former life has essentially been excised and lost for good. So I think for them, the adjustment was massive and a real regauging of, their identity, and they had to develop a whole new way of understanding themselves and their surroundings. I think for them is very tough. I think for me, it was 15 is a funny age anyway. You're trying to fit in, make friends, and it's a socially awkward age. And then you add to that I didn't know any English. I didn't know anybody, any of my surroundings. The culture was completely foreign. So it was just really disorienting. And, I landed in a regular high school within 2 weeks of our arrival and just immediately became part of the wallpaper, the background for the better part of those 4 years. But I remember, my mom was so embarrassed. She would take us to the supermarket and then we'd be standing in line and then she would pay for the food with food stamps. And she was so concerned that somebody from her former life would see her in this sort of state of fall from grace. And she would be so mortified and worried that somebody would spot us. I guess that's part of the reason I went to medicine, because I just didn't want to go through that.
Well, something just popped into my head, and I'm curious if your experience that you had speaks to any of your politics about government benefits and immigration policy.
I do. My heart do go out to people who are in the same position as we were. And, part of what I've talked about in my role as a ambassador for the UN Refugee Agency has been, sort of talking about how the refugee crisis is being treated as if it's, the problem of a handful of developing countries. 80% of refugees, find asylum or take refuge in countries that are still developing themselves and can barely tend to the needs of their own people. And the West isn't really pulling its own weight. If my narrative has any kind of positive impact, it's that, that people who are, asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants, they can be a real asset to communities and they can really contribute in a positive way, economically, artistically, culturally, professionally, to their host communities. And I hope that the West is more recognizant of that fact and that we start treating the crisis of the displaced people around the world as an international problem rather than kind of take on a sort of a fortress mentality.
Talking about your parents and your family again, did you have a sense that there was any struggle to maintain cultural values and traditions, or was that even a priority when you were growing up?
It was a priority. My parents tried, but I think they were also so entangled in the struggles of trying to provide for the family and find a direction in our lives. I do remember that my father would say, that we can only speak Farsi at the house, so English is not allowed. And then he had this jar where if anybody said a word of English, we would have to be fined a quarter and you'd have to toss in a quarter. It worked for a little while, and then we busted him for saying English words, so he would ended up having to toss money of his own. So it kind of became a fun thing. But the idea was, to try and maintain some sense of identity and heritage. And they tried very hard, and this succeeded, I think, to a large extent. And I say that because it matters to me. As apparently it worked because it matters to me now as a parent myself. And I've enrolled my kids in Farsi school, and so they've learned to read and write Farsi, and want them to be aware of our customs, our culture. I have no illusions that Afghan way of life and culture means to them what it means to me, just as it didn't mean to me what it meant to my parents. So there's a dilution with each generation, but I do think it's enriched my life and sort of allowed me to have a better sense understanding of myself, and I think it would do the same for my kids.
Yeah, it's also interesting just the challenge of your family being a part of that first wave of Afghan community, in at least in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to be a part of that first wave because things aren't already established for you, services aren't already there, and it's hard to find people.
Mm-hmm. English is actually my third language because I spent 4 years in France. The next language I learned after my mother tongue was French, and I became quite fluent in French. I actually started writing in French. But, you know, I learned English when I came to the States. But there is a benefit to my having arrived here at 15. I mean, you're still pliable. You're not quite, you know, rigid yet. And you're still able to learn and quickly. And so I picked up English within, I think, a year and a half. I was pretty fluent. I've always had sort of a knack for languages, I think. So there's the element of that. But also I was young. And so now English to me feels... When I write, it feels extremely natural. I mean, I don't write in Farsi anymore. I write purely in English.
It must feel more difficult to write in Farsi,
yeah.
At least at the literary level.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I can write a letter in Farsi, and I can read and write. I mean, I can read a newspaper and so on. But I don't have a literary voice in my head, you know, when it comes to Farsi.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is an interview with Khalid Husseini, author of the novel And the Mountains Echoed. After talking about his transition to the United States from Afghanistan, we discussed the success and responses to his novels.
How's the Afghan community, as well as the Afghan-American community, responded to your writing?
I think, based on the letters that I get, it's been largely positive. You know, I think particularly among the urban sort of youngish professionals, educated Afghans, there's quite a strong sense of embracing my books. I think each subsequent book has been embraced more and more. My first book was problematic for some members of my community because it touched on such really kind of raw nerve kind of issues that it was divisive to some extent, and some members took exception to the things that I was saying, not because they were false, but because I was saying them.
And they were honest.
And yeah, and they were, you know, these things are better kept in-house. So anyway, but in my impression is that based on the feedback that I've received, that people are happy, that the book is doing well because it gives non-Afghans something to say about Afghanistan. It doesn't have to do with, you know, the usual things, extremism and Taliban and, you know, so on and so forth. And also, they see their own lives in these stories. They see their own experiences. They identify with my characters. But, you know, if you have lived in exile for a long, long time, and then you write books about very divisive issues set in your homeland, you can imagine that the people who live there will have strong opinions about what you write, one way or the other. And so that's more or less been my experience.
How long did it take you to write your first novel? And then this novel, this most recent one, has come after 6 years, from what I understand.
Well, I began writing And the Mountains Echoed in November of 2009. So it's been 6 years since my last publication, but I didn't really take 6 years to write this book. It took about two and a half years or so to write this book. And I think... You know, the embracing by the Afghan is because my books have gotten slightly less political as I've written them. Certainly the first one was very, very charged politically, at least in Afghanistan. It may not seem so to somebody living in the U.S., but if you live in the Afghan community, you would get it immediately. And I knew that when I wrote the book. The second one, less so. And I think the Mountains Echoed is probably, of the three books, the one that is the least political. I mean, the war is there, and the Russians and the Taliban, they're there, but they're more in the background. And the impact they have on the lives of the characters is sort of less urgent, less forceful.
And how did you feel about the movie version of the Kite Runner?
I thought it was a good movie, and I was really proud of the kids in the movie. I thought, you know, they were completely amateurs, and they did a beautiful job. I thought they were really turned in beautiful performances. I thought the movie sort of captured the emotional essence of the book. You know, you can't have it entirely your way because, you know, so much of what you worked so hard for has been removed, and that's sort of the deal going in. So you have to make your peace with that. If you're okay with that, then you have the right mindset for a film adaptation. If you're the kind of writer that says everything that I write is non-negotiable, then you probably should just keep the rights and never make a movie.
Did you have a lot of input with the screenplay?
Or? Not the screenplay. I know David Benioff wrote it. I sort of made myself available to him, to Mark Forster, who was a director, to the producers, and said, you know, if you have questions for me, you want input from me, let me know. And occasionally they did ask me for advice on a few things. But mostly I just kept myself on the sidelines. And I thought it was a good movie, but more importantly, I think it was a film that was so different in one sense that, you know, Hollywood sort of treats that region kind of the same way all the time. And it's sort of the point of entry into stories in that region of the world is always political turmoil, terrorism, political violence, extremism, that sort of thing. And this was a very ordinary story. It was, you know, about a boy and his dad and, you know, his friend. And it was kind of this very intense human drama. And here was this entire cast of, you know, people from that region of the world, of that faith, whose nationality and sort of faith was kind of incidental to the story, really. I mean, that's exaggerating it a little bit, but it was, the primary focus really was the human element of it. And so I thought that was kind of a change for Hollywood that's kind of had a checkered past with that region.
My last questions are looking more at your work with the UN
mm-hmm.
as a goodwill envoy.
Mm-hmm.
So first, tell us about your foundation and working to shift the status quo of education for women in Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, the bulk of what I've tried to do with my foundation is to grant funds to projects that benefit people just like the characters in my books. Most of the funds that we've given out to projects in Afghanistan has gone to women and children. Our biggest undertaking with the foundation so far has been funding a shelter program for homeless families in Afghanistan. These are people who returned to Afghanistan, former refugees, they're returnees, and they've tried to resettle. And so many of them end up living out in the open or in makeshift sort of shelters or in abandoned public buildings where there's no water, no sewage, no protection from the elements. And so there's a shelter program that has been working in Afghanistan through the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, since the 80s. And we've been funding that program for the last several years. But we've also funded programs that benefit women. We're supporting the education of women who are medical residents, who are trying to go through medical training, providing funds to protect children who are in the rug-making industry so that they're not exploited and they have a chance at receiving education, you know, helping fund the building of learning centers for women and children. So that's sort of the kind of projects that appeal to me, the kind of projects where I find that we can make the biggest difference.
You know, women's rights is a global issue. So do you have any comments on how globally we can get more equality?
Well, I mean, I'll just use Afghanistan as a microcosm. There's no quick fixes. I mean, it's important to have awareness. It's important to have these important dialogues about these issues, and that helps. But ultimately, things have to change from within. As frustrated as you and I might be, and as deeply, you know, hopeful that we might be to see change, we really can't bring meaningful change. You know, it has to come from within. What those places need, and I'll use Afghanistan, and Afghanistan needs a sort of an intrinsic cultural shift. There's nothing that you and I can say to change the reality there. The only meaningful change that will happen in Afghanistan, the one that will be enduring, is the one that brought on by the Afghans themselves. I do foresee problems for women in the future of Afghanistan as I see them now. Things have improved in the last 10 years significantly, but in pockets, in urban areas for women. Those are not insignificant improvements. I mean, women serving in parliament, women running for president, women on television, women working in hospitals, back in the teaching schools and so on. So these are very significant things and extend beyond the symbolic. But you go to parts of Afghanistan, in the villages, in the rural areas, things haven't changed at all. Almost, you still have child brides, you still have bride price, you still have endemic domestic abuse, women who are barred from having any kind of public life. And we can't change that. The Afghan people have to change it themselves. And my one really kind of thing that I'm banking on and hoping is that Afghanistan is a very young nation. It's an increasingly urban nation. 60% of people are under the age of 20. Many of those are now connected to the outside world through technology, the internet, the airwaves. There's a new way of thinking among those people. They've come of age during the wars and they're sick of it. They're engaged more increasingly in building civil society. And I think that will be the way that Afghanistan will change. New information, new ways of thinking will be infiltrate the culture and bring it as sort of a meaningful change from within. But people have tried to, quote unquote, bring women's rights to Afghanistan in the past, you know, going back to the early 20th century. It has failed each time.
As a goodwill envoy, what are some of the tales that stand out to you most?
My book, in my new book, was, you know, the main central characters are a brother and sister. And I kind of wrote them, and it was only later that I remembered that I had met a pair of sisters in this kind of very remote, desolate part of Afghanistan, north of Kabul. They were living on this patch of land with their family, and it might as well have been a lunar landscape. There was so little civilization around them, very little access to water, to schools. And the two sisters were so kind of clinging to each other, and they were so close that I was very moved and touched by their obvious affection for each other. And it really wasn't until I began writing my book and kind of finished that first or the second chapter that I realized that I had been thinking about the sisters. And this is not uncommon for me. I'll write an entire thing and realize later that I'm thinking about where the inspiration came from. So I was very touched by those two sisters that I met.
My last question, if President Obama can truly withdraw troops from Afghanistan by 2014, what are your feelings about this and the future of Afghanistan?
Anxiety and uncertainty. I think a lot of Afghans, to some justifiable degree, feel that the jury is out on what the Afghan state is capable of doing. Can they protect its own people? Can they administer, deliver services and so on? Some Afghans feel, and I've spoken to them both here and in Afghanistan, that a doomsday scenario, a return to the militia warfare of the 1990s, is a fait accompli, and it will happen when the foreigners leave. Others, and that include myself in the second group, feel that perhaps important lessons have been learned in the last 10 years, 12 years, about the benefits of peace, and that the parties that were involved in those wars have learned a lesson. You never know, but one does hope. So I think it's mainly a time of uncertainty. At some point, there's going to be some kind of negotiation between the insurgents and the Afghan state. And my hope is that the folks who are sitting at the table are representative, truly, of the Afghan society, and that what they put on the table is a appropriate representation of the national will of the young people of Afghanistan who deserve the things that they've begun to achieve in the last 10 years, some freedom, personal freedom, freedom of expression, you know, desire to take part in political process, women's rights. Hopefully these things are treated as red lines and not as bargaining chips. But that process could be painful to watch from outside. But, you know, I remain hopeful about the long term because of the things that I said earlier. But I do have some concerns about the short term.
Thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure.
And thank you for chatting with us at KBOO.
It's my pleasure entirely. Thank you.
That was physician, UN Goodwill Envoy, and best-selling writer Khalid Husseini. He is the author of three novels, The Kite Runner, A Thousand Splendid Suns, and the latest, And the Mountains Echoed. You can learn more at khalidhusseini.com. This has been Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
Your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2. 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And thanks to a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.